Everyone has a story. Everyone travels a road. Some of those roads are paved, some are gravel, some are a combination. Some are superhighways. Some of us have met with sharp turns, intersections, and delays. We travel at different speeds to different destinations. On this podcast, we talk about your road to now. Welcome to Your Road to Now. Today, we sit down with Paul Moxness, raised in Kelowna, graduated in 1978 at KSS, then off to Europe.
That's right.
30-some years.
40 years.
40 years. Holy cow, 40 years. Why don't you fill in those gaps for us and kind of tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so after I graduated high school, well, first, thanks for having me, Jim. Appreciate it. This is my first podcast, so I'm going to do my best. But after I graduated high school, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And the reason why I went to Europe is actually twofold. One, Roots had been on TV. Everyone was out trying to discover their roots and things like that. But the other was that my father had the opportunity to go to Europe with his father when he graduated high school in 1949. He declined and basically had the worst year of his life and regretted it ever since. So when we grew up, he always told us that if you wanted to do what I didn't do and take the opportunity to go to Europe, discover your roots, that would be our high school graduation present. So that was my high school graduation present, was a one-way ticket to Europe, basically.
So did you have plans on staying there, or that just kind of developed as you went there?
No, the plan was to stay a year and then tell my parents, okay, I'm done, I'm coming back. I went to Norway, that's where my grandfather was from. My older brother had done the same thing in 75. He did it properly, came back in 76. I just didn't come back.
So you're gone for how many years?
40 years and
40
a week.
Years. So did you come back a couple of times?
Yeah, I was back probably, I don't know, hard to say, but every second year on average.
Okay, so there was no big shock when you got back to Kelowna, when just like this small town, and all of a sudden it turned into a pretty good city.
And that's what everybody says, like, have you seen all the big changes? And it's like, okay, I can see some new buildings, I can see the spread, but on the other hand, it's the same city, you know, I can still find my way around pretty well.
So what was the opportunity that kind of kept you in Europe? Like,
so I went to, in Norway, they have what they call a folk high school. It was kind of a gap year school that kids lived at to learn how to live on their own. There was subjects, but no exams. So halfway through the year there, they had a career day. So local businesses would come in and you know, show kids, these are your opportunities in this part of the country. And I met a counselor from a university, and she said, you know, it would be a shame if you're just getting the hang of the language. It would be a shame if you left after a year, and, you know, 2, 3, 4 years down the road, you've probably forgotten all the language and everything. So have you considered getting into university? And I hadn't. I had no plans for what I wanted to do. She explained that there was no tuition, so it was basically free to go
to
university.
Tempting.
That was tempting. That was probably the key selling point. So I signed up. And in those days, you needed actually 2 years of post-high school education to get in from Canada. But this was in Trondheim, about halfway up the country. And they had quotas for foreign students, and they never filled their quota. So I was accepted, and I think they probably got some kind of government subsidy, so it was great to get another foreigner on the list. Mm. I was accepted based on if I could pass an entrance exam. So I did that, took the entrance exam, and then away I went.
So you finished a couple of years of university there?
Yeah, well, it was free, right? So I became like a perpetual student. And to get my visa extended, I had to go to the police department every 6 months and basically have a letter with me from the university saying I had 20 credits.
Right.
Those 20 credits didn't necessarily need to add up to anything in particular. So it was just 20 credits. So my university studies were all over the map. I focused a lot on psychology, and those kind of things. But I also did biology. I did some computer science. I did whatever was interesting to me at the time, just so I could get the 20 credits so I could get my visa extended. So I went to university for about 6 years.
Well, good for you.
Yeah.
It must have been a great experience. And then into the work world, you decided to stick around there as well. And how did that opportunity come about?
Yeah, so, I went all the way up to master's level in psychology. I was thinking of getting into research, not clinical research, but I studied a lot of developmental and organizational psychology. And I basically dropped out without my master's degree because I had a bit of a disagreement with my mentor. So he wanted me to continue this research for 4 years. And I was like, I'm not doing this for 4 years to get a diploma to hang on my wall. And so I walked out, and then I asked myself, okay, what do you really want to do? And I wanted to work in travel. And for me, travel was kind of airports and airlines. By the time I got out of university and things, I was about 26, 27 years old. And university was free, but it wasn't very well paid. So I'd been living kind of a minimum existence level for a while. And so I was getting kind of desperate to get a job in travel, but nobody would hire me because I had no experience, no background. My education wasn't, typical for, getting a job at an airport or anything like that. And so I was getting refusal after refusal, and then I saw an ad in the newspaper for a job as a night security guard in a hotel, a five-star hotel. It was owned by an airline, and so I thought, security guard, how hard can that be? It's a foot in the door at part of the airline, yeah. And so, I could get that job and then down the road apply for real travel jobs. That's basically, I stayed at that company for 31 years.
And there was some big moments as you were there?
There was big moments even before I got there, because just getting a job was a big stroke of luck. I'd never really been in a five-star hotel before, so when I went for the job interview, I couldn't force myself to enter through the main entrance of the hotel. I was like, getting these we're not worthy images in my head that, you don't belong here. I saw all the brass and fancy things in through the door. So I walked around, I got to the side of the hotel, and I'm thinking, you really need a job. You can't walk away from an interview. And that hotel had a shopping arcade on the side. I went in there, went up and had the interview, and the security manager was an ex-cop, and typical, hotel security manager for the time. He's looking at me, he's looking at my CV, and he says, you're too old and you're too educated for this job. I just need a kid that's out of the military, loyal, honest, and sober. And I'd never been in the military either, so it was like, I'm getting all these strikes against me, but I really needed the job. I started to defend myself, not knowing anything about hotels or security. I'm trying to convince the guy that I'm the right person for the job. And he just looked at me and said, you have way too many opinions. And so I didn't leave the interview with a great feeling, but a couple of weeks later he phoned me up and he said, I'll be really honest with you, I don't want to hire you, but there was only two applicants for the job and the other guy withdrew. And so I was the only one left, and that was my start.
So the hotel was in a city?
It was in
city?
Oslo, in Oslo? The capital of Norway.
And, yeah. And the name of the hotel?
It was, at the time, it was the SAS Scandinavia Hotel. It was owned by Scandinavian Airlines. Now it's Radisson Blue. And so my whole career, I stayed with the same company, but the company went through growth and change and mergers and acquisitions and alliances, and it's now part of the Radisson Hotel.
Can you hit
group.
Some of the highlights of those 40 years there?
There's a whole lot of them, but
some of the big ones.
So for me, the reason why I stayed there and didn't start applying for jobs in the airline was that just the first weekend, this is the end of the 80s, 1987, the economy had really been booming. And Norway now is a very wealthy country. But in those, when I got there, it was like a third world country for me. Telephones were not common in people's houses, let alone cell phones and all that kind of stuff. And so by the end of the 80s, the oil revenue had really started to turn over. The money was freely flowing there. A lot of it was based on credit, but we had, I mean, in security, we spent weekends running back and forth to the storeroom getting champagne and caviar that we could take up to the nightclub. So it opened a whole new world for me.
So I just want to back up for a second. So you got that job because there's only you and another guy that applied. So it's kind of an opportunity.
Yeah.
And then when did the next, like you're the night security guard. How long did that last and what was the next opportunity?
So try to remember here, but I started as night security, but we pretty soon went into a rotating shift. So you worked three shifts, either day, night, or evening shift. About probably a year and a half, 2 years into my career, some of us in the department got invited on a boat trip with the security manager. And he took us out onto the fjord outside of Oslo there. We get pretty far away from land. And then he says to us, so everybody knows that this new big fancy hotel was going to open in the city. It's going to be bigger than our hotel. It's going to be fancier than our hotel. And he said, they're offering 50% more salary for people to come from our hotel, which was like the premier hotel in the city, into this new hotel that was being built. And so he said, you're my chosen ones. And there, I think there was like five or six of us with him on the boat. He said, you're the ones that I'm taking. He said, I'm going to that new hotel. You're the ones that I've chosen to come with me. And the first thing I said to him was, I'm not coming. And I almost thought he was going to throw me overboard and make me swim back to land. But that was a huge opportunity for me. It wasn't like I didn't want money, but it was more that, because we were owned by the airline, we had some travel benefits that airline employees had. And those, for me, were kind of more important than going to this new hotel that I knew nothing about just for money. And so what happened was the other five guys went with them, and that kind of bumped me up the seniority ladder pretty high.
For you.
Yeah, so I went from like just being a regular guard pretty much overnight to becoming the assistant security manager in the hotel. The funny part of that is like 2 years later, probably because they paid their employees too much, that other hotel company went broke. And they're now part of the Radisson Hotel Group. But I was like 2 months away from becoming...
So now all those guys work for you.
Yeah, well, exactly. I was 2 months away from becoming my old boss's boss. He retired like 2 months before we took over the hotel.
That's quite the shift there.
Yeah. But so again, it was a really interesting time for security and geopolitically in the world because in the late 80s, you had things like the Berlin Wall were coming down. Mm-hmm. The Soviet Union was disintegrating. Norway in particular was trying to broker a peace deal between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And so because we were the premier hotel, because we were owned by Scandinavian Airlines, and so government had a little bit of control with us, we hosted a lot of really high-profile visits. And so I was learning on the fly, not only hotel security and hotel operations, but also how things fit together at a bigger geopolitical geopolitical way as well. And you know, you would get all these negotiators coming through. We had the first official visit Yasser Arafat made. He was living in Libya at the time, and so his first official visit as like a head of state or whatever you could call it was to our hotel. I think he'd been back and forth to Norway on covert visits that didn't take place in hotels, but I certainly remember the day that he came on an official visit, and how much planning and all that went into those things. A couple of years, a part of that as well was we became enrolled in, well, the, some people at the foreign ministry. Norway had the longest serving monarch at the time in the world. The guy was completely revered. But he was getting older, and so somebody at the foreign ministry looked at, you know, when he passes, we need to have a plan for a state funeral, because they figured between 70 and 90 countries would send a head of state or somebody very high up to represent at a state funeral, and there was no plan, right? And so, again, they came to Scandinavian Airlines and said, we need a plan. And mm-hmm. and the head of security for Scandinavian Airlines Norway at the time was a British guy, who had, this was his life, was making big plans for big events. So all these things are happening between 87 when I started. The king died the night Gulf War I started, so January 1991. And, you know, I'd been working on it covertly for 2 years. It cost me my first marriage because I hadn't told my wife I was working on this thing. I did have a lot of late nights and things like that. But I had to wake her up when I got the phone call and said, oh, by the way, I have this little secret I never told you about. I have to go to work. And when I got back 10 days later after the funeral, she's like, I don't want to be married to you anymore. So probably would have happened anyway, but blessing in disguise, it gave me a 10-year gap where I could focus completely
on my job.
Yeah. The company was exploding at the time. Mm-hmm. We were growing everywhere, and I was free to just jump on a plane and go. So really opened up opportunities.
So what are some of the biggest highlights of the 40 years there? Like you're involved in some things?
Yeah. There's so many. It's multiple Olympic Games. It's planning for all these things. It's high level openings. We were all over the place. I remember we were converting a hotel in Amman, Jordan, from a privately operated hotel to a branded hotel. And they had sold it based on the fact, or we were taking over the hotel because the International Air Transport Association, so all the major airlines in the world, were going to have their annual meeting there. We were going to be the host hotel. The only problem was the renovation wasn't going to be ready in time for this huge big event. And for Scandinavian Airlines, they were putting their name on the line. And I remember the CEO of the company at the time, he was in Amman a couple of days before the event kicked off, and he phoned me and said, you have to come down here, because he said, you know, we know we're not ready. We're flying in people from all over to make sure service levels are where they are. But he said, you know, security is the most important thing. He said, I'll just sleep better if I know you're here.
So that's a great thing during to have this event. CEO exactly. rely on you. So obviously you had earned favor from the CEO. You got to travel the world.
Yep.
You got to see lots of different properties.
So I was working in travel, and nice. I used to say,
you
know,
in travel.
It was great when I worked when we were owned by the airline and you had these travel benefits.
Right.
It was even better when they paid you to travel.
Right? Yeah, and then you were kind of getting to see a bunch of different operations. Different
yeah,
countries.
And actually my first international trip in business class was, because we were owned by the airline, there'd been an incident in Cairo where there was a hotel fire where the Scandinavian Airlines crew were staying. Fortunately, none of them were injured or killed or anything, but it had a huge impact on the airline because the flight was canceled. It cost so much money to reroute all the passengers, to fly a new crew down, to get the plane, and all the, you know, the ripple effect of that kind of thing cost millions. And so one of the crew members had written a letter into the internal magazine for staff and said, you know, the company should do a better job of choosing safe hotels for us. And so I wrote to the CEO of the airline and said, hey, we have, you know, hotels. Our hotels are safe and secure, so we can help you guys choose hotels. And long story, so I I set up a system for them, and then they, my first trip to go to check one of the hotels for them was to Hong Kong, and so I was shocked when I got the ticket, because it was business class that I'd never flown. I think we were halfway over Russia before I figured out how to work the seat and things like that. But you know, those things, they stick out. Is like, yeah, yeah. It was just like a completely different world compared to what I was used to.
Doing hotel security for that long, there must have been a couple of weird and wacky moments where you were like, oh my God, did that just happen?
Like, there's a lot. And that, you know, I said that right away when this new world opened up for me, standing in the lobby of this crazy hotel that is just booming business, you saw so many things. I think it was probably within the first week or two, I just started thinking, this is where I belong, because I want to... They didn't teach me this when I studied psychology for 5 or 6 years. You know, you'd see, like, people that were known from TV would come, you know... One guy came in riding on a bicycle at 4 o'clock in the morning, trying to, and it's tragic because he was trying to sneak an underage girl up to a room. And so you saw really exciting things, really fun things, all the celebrities you ever wanted to see, all the politicians, Nelson Mandela.
That's a big moment.
I mean, the guy, he had just an aura around him, but... and then you saw the other side, which was all these tragedies with trafficking, suicides. Whatever happens in the outside world happens in a hotel, or can happen in a hotel. It's a small society.
Right.
When that CEO called me to come to Amman that time, when I got there, I'd been there quite a few times because we had this big renovation project. And when I landed, it was like around midnight probably. And they'd always send a car to pick me up at the airport. When I landed, there was nobody there. And I'm thinking, well, they probably figure I know my way by now. So I just jumped in a taxi and went to the hotel. When I got to the hotel, I'm coming in the lobby and I saw the night manager, who I also knew. And he was completely stressed out. He's like, just drop your bag. The general manager wants to see you immediately. It's a big disaster. And I'm thinking, oh, why didn't I stay at home or something? And I turned around. The general manager is running through the lobby. He's, oh, you're finally here. It's crazy. It's, oh, the CEO has lost everything. And so when we get in the elevator, we're going up to the floor where the CEO was staying. He says that, you know, the CEO is going to check out at 3 o'clock in the morning because he had an early flight. And when he went to take his stuff out of the safe in the room, his passport and wallet and stuff, everything was, it was empty. And so I asked the stupid questions, have you called the police? And he's like, have we called the police? We have every person from the chief inspector down is on the 10th floor. And so when I got up there, there's police everywhere. There's hotel management everywhere. And then it was surreal because then the CEO comes through this little crowd of people in his Royal Club bathrobe. And he says, oh, finally somebody I recognize. And he says, this is all your fault. And I said, oh, what do you mean it's my fault? And he said, you know, we have to put these safes in all the rooms. And so obviously I put my stuff in the safe. He said, I wanted to take it out so I didn't forget it when I check out at 3 o'clock in the morning. And it's empty. And I'm thinking, what are we going to do? And he said, you know, I know the hotel isn't finished. And this room safe is supposed to be bolted to the wall with a bracket and stuff. And that when he checked in, the bracket was still inside the safe because they hadn't had time to bolt it to the wall. And so basically we just went through this question. I asked him, what did you do with that? He called the GM, said, you know, don't show the guests that you're not finished, so come and take the bracket out. I asked the GM. GM said, well, I told my assistant, go up and take that out. Ask the assistant. Everybody's standing there. Ask the assistant, what did you do? It's, oh, this is an engineering thing. I told the engineer, get up there and fix the safe. Look at the engineer. I said, what are you doing? He said, oh, you don't have time to fix safes. I just told my assistant, go up there and switch it with the one in the room next door. And I said, have you looked in the room, one in the room next door? They said, yes, of course. It's not there. And I said, well, where's your assistant? And he said, he's sleeping. The guy hasn't slept for like a week because we're trying to get this hotel ready. And I said, well, go wake him up. Bring the guy up. And he said, I asked him the same question. What did you do? And he said, well, the safe was locked, so I didn't want to put it in the room next door. So I took it down, put it in our big safe downstairs. I said, go get it. And he went down and comes up with it. We gave it to the CEO and said, try your code on this one. Da, da, da. Opens the safe. Everything's inside. Jordanian police were completely impressed. They didn't really understand all the questions, what was going on, but they were super impressed that we solved the thing in 5 minutes. So things like that, they also stick in your mind.
Good common sense stuff, So I noticed that you do some updates on LinkedIn and stuff, and you use a signature there, communicate, collaborate, contribute. And where did that come from, and why does that stick so strongly for you? Like, what does that mean to you?
I think that has kind of been my success in my whole career.
The communication one obviously worked because you could communicate with the people there and get the right answer as opposed
to panic. And it's so the way I look at it is that I was completely not qualified for my job, right? And so I've also...
Are we ever qualified, though?
Yeah, you never know, right? And so one of the things I've always kind of followed is Richard Branson has a saying that if someone gives you an amazing opportunity and you're not sure if you can do it, say yes and then figure it out. And so I'm handed these opportunities, right, where I just kind of float up through this massive growing company. And I ended up as global vice president for safety and security, and I have no security background. I have no hotel background. But my thing was always that, you know, you have to communicate with people. You have to find out what it is they need that you can support. And then the collaboration part is you look at what do they bring to the table? What do you bring to the table? So how can you work together towards common objectives? And then the contribute part is that, and this is where I think sometimes people make the mistake of thinking that if I join this organization, if I want to work together with these people, if I'm out there, what can I get for it? And because we live in this society where everything's kind of a transaction, right? And so I think for me, it's always been, what can I contribute and how can I contribute? And the more genuine I've been at really contributing without thinking what's in it for me, the more I've received back. And so that's where communicate, collaborate, contribute comes from.
It's a great saying. So you're back home now after 40 years.
Yeah.
And so what are you doing now? Like what gets you up in the morning? What gets you excited? What's the drive now?
There's a lot going on right now. So when after 31 years, we were going through a new ownership and they brought in completely new management to the company. I think at the time it was only the CFO and myself who were legacy people that had reported back to the big CEO we had for probably 25 years. And basically they wanted to make some changes that I just didn't want to make. And I'd been through like 4 or 5 ownership changes before, and I'm thinking I'm getting too old for this stuff. I don't want to reboot the whole thing again. And so I did a deal with the company that I would leave in 2018, and then they retained me as a consultant for a year. They even paid for our relocation to here. So it was a good break with the company after such a long time. So that when we got here, I'm still retained as a consultant for them. Not that I had to do a lot of work, but it really allowed my wife and I to land here and figure out, okay, what's new in Kelowna? You know, what are the opportunities here? After a year, when the consulting agreement ended, my exclusivity to Radisson ended as well. So I started to talk with a couple of former colleagues, the global chief security officer for Hyatt and Intercontinental Hotels. They both left their companies the same time I left mine, just by coincidence. And we were talking on the phone. We thought, you know, we're getting old, but we're not that old. We can still maybe contribute something. So we've set up our own company that we just launched now, North Point International.
Mm-hmm. So that's a consulting firm for other
So that's
other
a consulting
properties?
Firm for the hotel and tourism industry. Our plan was to launch in January this year. When word got out that we were talking to each other and we're looking at doing something, we actually had to jumpstart our thing because we got invitations to... I spoke at the UN last year at a Security Council Counterterrorism Committee briefing. From there, we got invited to some workshops.
So doors just keep opening now.
Doors have been opening. So, but that is what I spend my time on mostly today.
So that sounds pretty exciting.
Yeah. And then locally, it's amazing. We feel like we have a really good thing that can really help both the hotel industry, which is strange and fragmented, and I think most people don't understand that because a hotel has a brand name on it, they don't necessarily have the corporate support that company represents, and so because they're franchised, and so we want to help build bridges between the franchise communities and the corporations that run them, to make sure that those franchises also have access to expertise and tools and things like that they can't get from the brand, but also to build partnerships with government and organizations like the UN. And there's just so much going on that the five of us can hardly keep up, and we're thinking what we just wanted something to do, right?
So networking obviously has been a big part of this success now too. So, and I know that you reached out to us when we were doing Level Up and gave us some great information in regards, because we had two former prime ministers at Level Up, and you shared some information with us, your experiences, and I think you're on LinkedIn quite a bit. So where do you kind of communicate? How do you do most of your networking? What advice would you give younger people coming in behind you and how they should kind of put themselves out there?
So, yeah, and the number one thing is put yourself out there, right? Don't be afraid to, because, again, I started out, I'm completely not qualified, right? And so, but I worked for a well-respected big company. And so I went out and said, hey, I work for this well-respected big company. I want to be part of this organization. I want to meet with you. I talked a lot to our corporate clients, their heads of security, because I look at my job as being part of the hotel. And we're a service industry, so when we ask guests, you know, what do you like in the room? Do you want 20 channels on TV? Do you want 24-hour work? What do you want? I asked those same questions of my counterparts in security and said, well, how can we best support you? And by asking those questions, I actually found out a lot about mm-hmm. what was important in the security world for them. And then I always went to the top. I never went down low, because I always figured things filter down better than they filter up. And so if I ever had anything, I'd go as high up as I could get. And when you also contribute, when you're offering advice, when you're open and honest with people, they become more open and honest back to you. And I've been to probably 65, 70 countries, and it works everywhere. You know, you scrape away a little bit of language and culture, and there is no difference between people. That, for me, was also a real eye-opener when I traveled around, that the people I met that had the same kinds of job I had, they were the same kinds of people I was. And the people that were in sales were typical salespeople, and the people that were in, you know, government were typical government people. It was really weird to see how much more alike we were than different.
I think you definitely found success in that. If I think back or listen back to what you had said earlier and saying you wanted to be in the travel industry, and then you just said you've been in 65 different countries, that's pretty amazing.
It is, and you know, for me, I still, when I go into a new hotel or a new place in a new country, I still remember the day I went for that job interview and couldn't force myself in the main entrance. Right? I still have that feeling that, you know, I feel completely fortunate to have those opportunities.
The good news is people need to take a chance, I guess, right? People need to push themselves past their comfort zone, take a chance, and doors will open. And opportunity favors the prepared mind, I guess, too.
And I think, you know, I became a manager pretty quickly because everybody went to the other hotel. And again, I'm still pretty much a rookie in both the hotel part and the security part. One thing I always did was make sure that anybody that reported to me, they knew what they were doing better than I could have done their job. So it wasn't about me being the boss and knowing everything. It was about me organizing things so that we had the best possible people doing the best possible thing.
In almost any job, though, is hire people that are better than you at some of the tasks that need to be done.
Exactly, because you can't do everything yourself. And if you were better than them, you're never going to be as good as you need to be as a group. And that's also one of my proudest accomplishments was that the people that were my direct reports at corporate level never left. So when I left, my number two guy, he had more seniority in the company than I did. My number three guy had 28 years seniority. So he was almost where I was. And our junior guy only had 12 years. But none of them left while they reported to me. And that, for me, made me super proud, you know, because something kept them there, and it probably wasn't the paycheck. So
we've been at this for a while. We're going to go to a quick fire round here just to kind of listen to a couple other thoughts from you. And I'm going to bring it back to Kelowna a little bit. Favorite place to dine in Kelowna?
Oh, that's a good one because we love to go out and eat.
But I see that on your Instagram.
Yeah, exactly. So we've been going to Skinny Duke's quite a bit since they opened. And I'm waiting for my brother to come. My younger brother, he's living in Prague right now. But I've told him, when you come, we're going to Skinny Duke's because it's like, it's Kelowna when we grew up, right? Yeah. It's the 70s.
You must have eaten in some really cool places in the world, and all of a sudden Skinny Duke's is your place.
Yeah, and I mean, we had hotels with Michelin star restaurants in them. One in Brussels, I think, had two Michelin stars. Mm. And I think I'm probably the only person in the corporate office that never went there. Uh-huh. They gave me a gift card when I had my 30th anniversary. I gave it to my wife and said, you know, take your girlfriend and go for lunch there.
Hire you as an influence for Skinny Dukes.
Yeah, exactly. They could do that. No, but we just like it there because I think the second time we were there, they recognized us. And
that's always makes you feel good when people.
It makes you feel at home.
And there's a couple of restaurants in town that do a really good job at that, and it's not done enough. I mean, that really makes, because that's why you want to take your brother there, because you're like, hey, Paul, come on in. And
exactly.
It makes you feel important. No, remember Cheers?
Yeah, exactly. Everybody knows your name, right?
That's right. Book that you would suggest somebody needs to read, like your favorite book.
I would say right now. It's not a new book, but Give and Take by Adam Grant was quite influential on the way I started to look at my career and basically my life. I thought he had some really good points in there. At the time, he wasn't very well known, so he was super approachable as well. I dropped him a couple of emails. We corresponded back and forth. And he seems very genuine to the thoughts that he had in that book. So Give and Take by Adam Grant, I like.
Is there a movie you kind of watch over and over? Is there a favorite movie?
I don't usually watch movies more than once. So I'd say probably no. It would change depending on my mood and whatever. You ask my wife. She watches movies over and over.
And I guess if somebody was to play your life, who would you pick to play that role?
It'd have to be somebody ugly, probably. But, no, I have no idea.
No?
My brother works in the film and TV business, so I would leave that up to them to figure out if they ever wanted to do that.
If you could go back and talk to 20-year-old you, is there something you would say, hey, avoid this, do this?
Yeah, so when I was 20... I was, my biggest wish in life was to be 40, because I figured when I'm 40, I'll be married, have kids, everything will be settled down. And my life at 20 was pretty chaotic, because I didn't have enough money to survive, basically, because I was restricted to how much I could work in Norway and on my student visa. And they ended up, I had three jobs, but I got called into the police. They took away, they said, you have one visa. It's one visa, one job. And I said, I can't survive on one job. I have three, but they don't add up to 20 hours a week, which is what I was allowed. And they said, too bad, one visa, one job. So for a while I was living on, in the student canteen at the university, a cup of coffee, a chocolate bar, and a newspaper all cost the same amount of money. And that was my disposable income after I paid my rent and bought rice and macaroni to live off of as food. And so if I was really strong-willed, I wouldn't buy anything on Wednesday and Thursday. Friday, I go into the canteen like a rich guy and buy a coffee and a chocolate bar and a newspaper. But living, so when I was 20, thing. I was completely, yeah, it was pretty chaotic. But you're young, so you don't really get it. So you just kind of, this is what you need to do, so you do it. But I remember telling myself, when you're 40, you know, all this will be behind you. You'll be living like a normal family life, blah, blah, blah. When I was 40, I moved to Copenhagen and basically started over, because I had left the company for a very brief time because me and the CEO didn't see eye to eye on, I wanted to work full-time security. Right. They were giving me all this other stuff to do as well. And so I left, I got hired back pretty much right away, and then they moved me to Copenhagen. And so when I was 40, I was basically starting over again. So I think what I tell my 20-year-old self, to make a long story even longer, is like, this is what it's gonna be like. There's always gonna be new challenges, new obstacles, new chaos. And the better you are at understanding that that's how life works, the more adaptable you'll be, the more flexible you'll be. And, you know, you won't focus on, oh, why did I do that? Or I shouldn't have done that. It's more like, okay, I'm here. Where do I go from here? You know, my wife and daughter will say to you, you know, whenever we got lost in the car, it wasn't about why did we take the wrong turn. It's like, okay, we're here. We still want to get there. Where do we go from here? I stopped the arguments about why we made the wrong turn pretty quickly and said, you know, doesn't help. We made that wrong turn. Now we have to figure out how we move on from here. And that's what I tell my 20-year-old self.
Kelowna, you've been gone for quite a while. How has the city done while you've been gone? Like, what do you think of Kelowna right now?
I think it's great. I think there's so much opportunity here. I think, you know, I give a shout out to Kelowna now, because when we knew we were coming back, we were following Kelowna now, and especially like you have an in focus thing about mm-hmm. somebody, and that's where we started to build our network here. When we saw somebody interesting there, I just reached out to them on LinkedIn and say, you know, hey, I grew up in Kelowna. We're coming back to Kelowna, but I didn't want to reach out to my old high school friends because I don't know them anymore. We mm-hmm. didn't have Facebook in those days. So we wanted to reach out to new people. And we met a lot of really good people since we started doing that. And I think just the whole way the city is trying to manage and plan for growth it makes me super optimistic. I think
it's a beautiful city.
It's beautiful. Like
we look out from here and from the 16th floor of here in Landmark. And I don't know of a nicer place in the world. I haven't been to 65 countries. I've been to maybe 10 or so, but I think to me, Canada is still one of the best countries in the world. And if I had to pick a province, I'd pick British Columbia because it's beauty. And then if I had to pick a place to live in British Columbia, I'd pick Kelowna or Vancouver.
Well, you know, we picked it. Yeah, we decided to come here mostly because my parents still live here. And I wanted to prove to my mom that I didn't stay away for the rest of my life. I did actually come back. Just took me longer than she expected. But seriously, no, I think that there is a lot of opportunity. People ask me, you know, where is this little place in Canada that you live? And I say, it's one stop from anywhere. We have excellent connectivity with the airport. You can fly direct, you know, to Vancouver, Calgary, Toronto, Seattle. So we are pretty much one stop from almost anywhere
like
in the world.
It's like a small town feel with big city amenities, the way I look at it. Because I mean, you could still, like, you don't want to have a road rage here because you might see that guy at the next coffee shop or something.
And that's another thing we have to get used to is people complaining about parking and traffic. And it's like, hey, we lived in Brussels for the last 10 years and there is no issue with parking or traffic in Kelowna yet. I think
there were 10 minutes to anywhere.
Well, we always end up at meetings at least 15 minutes in advance because we thought traffic would be worse. But at the same time, there'll be growth pains and things like that for Kelowna. But still, I think the way it's being planned out, it's the downtown will keep a downtown, small town feel. I think it's great that they're putting in more density on the population side because that will keep the vibrancy of the downtown. It won't be like so many places, especially in North America, where city center dies because nobody's there after 5-6 o'clock. So the vibrancy here is awesome. I think the university has been an awesome addition to Kelowna, both the university and the college. I think together, what is it, like 18,000-20,000 students here? And there's nothing like having young, energetic students coming out of university saying, I want to stay here. There's opportunity here. They're willing to take chances and start businesses and do things. That just adds to the whole atmosphere in the city that I think it's maybe underrated, but it's hugely beneficial to the city to have that many students. Especially as we grow, we'll need those kind of people to grow our businesses and make sure that we can do all the things that we're putting in the long-term plans for the city.
Well, thank you for sharing your road to now. Small town Kelowna boy.
Yeah.
World traveler. And you got a lot of chapters left to write, I imagine. You're still
game. I love to write and I am writing some stuff. That's kind of always been my therapy. But I really appreciate it, Jim. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Thank you. When we're out.
If you'd like to be part of this podcast, we'd love to share your story and your road to now.